Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During the 2008 presidential campaign, candidate Barack Obama made his life story and upbringing a part of his campaign, as we hear in this special report by Brian Williams of NBC News.
The beginning of Barack Obama's improbable journey began with an improbable union. An African man named Barack and a white Kansan named Stanley Ann wed at the dawn of the 60s, when interracial marriages were still illegal in many places. It lasted, though, just 3 short years, and their lives not much longer.
In his campaign and now in his presidency, the importance of family has become a major part of Barack Obama's identity. Today, we'll learn more about the life story of his mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, who greatly influenced the lives of her children and through her son, also a nation. Joining us today is Jenny Scott. She's author of a new biography, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Jenny has been a newspaper reporter for more than 30 years, most recently at the New York Times. She went on leave to research and write A Singular Woman. Welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
You wrote in the book about her outsider qualities, about being the perpetual outsider. As I read about her, that feeling never escaped me.
Yeah, obviously there's a role that temperament plays in this, but I also think her early experiences as a child influenced this. She grew up really, while we think of her as having been from Kansas, she actually grew up all over the United States. Her father was a not particularly successful furniture salesman. So she was born in Kansas. They moved to California, back to Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, and now out to Seattle when she was 13. And by that point, she'd moved, you know, 6 or 7 times in the first 13 years of her life. And according to people who knew her and her relatives, I interviewed close to 200 people for this book, she really, from a very early age, had a kind of wry, ironic take on the world, partly just from this always being plunged into new places as the new kid, the outsider, and having to explain herself. And interestingly enough, she chooses in later life to become an anthropologist, where the ethic is sort of that of the participant observer, kind of the natural posture that came to her as a child.
In fact, after reading the book, think she didn't feel like a Kansan at all to me, whatever that is.
I know. I that was one of the things that interested me first about this, is that we always knew of her really by one gross oversimplification, the white woman from Kansas, the white mother from Kansas. And that, I believe, was probably intended to conjure up a certain idea in our minds of sort of corn-fed, all-American, whatever the black father from Kenya was not. But the odd thing is, she so defies the stereotype we have of Kansas. Now, the stereotype is probably not accurate either entirely, mm-hmm. but she, not only did she spend relatively little time there, but she was so utterly unconventional, so unlike many people of her generation, women, Americans, mothers, and yet we're sort of told that she is the archetypal normal person.
Let's talk about the title now, since you bring that up. You said that the word singular, a singular woman, is neutral. But in my book, it also suggests remarkable. You've written that, too. But in my book, that sort of implies high praise.
Well, that's interesting. I thought about words like unconventional for the title. But mm-hmm. unconventional is taken by different people in different ways. Some people think of it as a badge of honor, and other people think of it as oddball. And I didn't want the word to immediately connote something to the person who's considering reading the book. I wanted it to simply conjure the idea of unusual, unique, remarkable in some way, and let them then draw their own conclusions from the facts. Because the facts of her life turn out to be rather polarizing to Americans. People are very divided based on the little bit they know about her, about whether she was a good mother, what kind of a person she was. And I think that's one of the interesting things about her whole story, is that the story itself is incredibly interesting to me as a story and as a life, but it also makes people think about their own choices.
My guest is Jenny Scott. She is the author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Jani, you've said that one of the incidents in her life that stand out for you is the impromptu road trip to San Francisco that she made during her senior year in high school. And to read about it was almost shocking in a way. It was the 60s, early 60s. You said it was a foreshadowing of what she would become.
Yeah, it was the very early 60s. In fact, it may have taken even place in late 1959. She was a senior in high school. She was in high school in Mercer Island, Washington, a very sedate, white, upper middle class suburb in Lake Washington, on an island in Lake Washington off Seattle. And she was, at that point, not an obvious rebel. She was clearly a nonconformist in that she didn't feel that she had to conform entirely to the culture of the high school, and she had some sort of nonconformist friends. But also, they were very good students, brainy, you know, did a lot of reading, asked interesting questions in class, participated. They weren't disaffected in any clear way. Anyway, one night, she and a couple of friends were coming back from a coffee house in Seattle. This is in their senior year, and they just started talking about, well, what if we don't go home? What if we just keep driving? And a kind of an argument broke out between Anne, who was called Stanley at the time, Stanley Anne, and a friend of hers, and then the third friend, who the third person in the car who didn't particularly think this was a good idea. They ended up dropping him off, getting in another car, and taking that car and driving all night south down the coast toward the Bay Area, picking up a hitchhiker along the way who then taught them how to remove the car radio to trade it for cash for gas, and then picking up another hitchhiker, and then finally finding their way to a friend's sister's house in the Bay Area and moving in. Now, this was a completely out of the normal line of activity for a kid from that area, and even for Stanley Ann Dunham, you know, unconventional as she might be. And the thing that was fascinating to me about it was this was really the first time we see this kind of impulse to break out, this very adventurous sensibility and a kind of openness to experience that really marked the rest of her life.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to go on a joyride to San Francisco. I'm sure millions have done it. But to actually move into somebody's apartment, pick up two hitchhikers, one of whom was pretty creepy.
And I understood from the two people the one who went with her and the one who chose not to go were the sources who told me about this. And I understood from them that really Anne was as much the driving force in this joyride as anyone. It was really she who said, yeah, let's go. And had she had any hesitation, they would never have done it.
Now, you never were able to figure out if she was punished for that, but let's talk about her appearance a little bit. Very unusual people themselves.
They were, yeah. Again, we imagine one thing, and when you look more closely, you find something quite different. They had grown up in small towns in Kansas during the Depression, and it turns out that some of her sort of adventurous streak and her willingness to defy convention really came from them, despite the fact that they are simply, you know, we think of them as this Kansas couple. Her mother had married against the will of her parents in secret while still in high school because her parents didn't like Stanley Dunham, Anne's father, Stanley Ann's father. And then as soon as she graduated from high school, Madeline Payne Dunham, the mother, they ran off to California together. So they were people like their daughter who were interested in what was beyond the next horizon. They then, when she was born, they ended up moving back, and Madeline Dunham became the sort of hardworking breadwinner in the family. And Stanley Dunham really never kind of figured out his métier, the thing he wanted to do with his life, and kind of bounced from furniture job to furniture job. But they cared a lot about Anne's education, and they made a real point of making sure that she was always in a great, you know, in the best school they could get. And when she later, she became pregnant at 17, there having moved finally to Hawaii. It was really a desire for her to be able to continue her education that I think played a significant role in their decision to support her, despite the fact that at 17 she had conceived a child with an African man, dropped out of college, and married him at a time when there were laws against interracial marriage in nearly two dozen states.
The idea that she married an African man, not, you know, is beside the point at this right now. She seemed more pragmatic, more down to earth than someone who would run off and get pregnant. And I'm generalizing, but it seemed like sort of an odd thing for her to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, get pregnant is the key, I guess.
Yeah.
Here was a kid who had apparently never really had a boyfriend in high school. She was described by a friend of hers who knew her as a graduate student as a young virgin at the time that she became pregnant. And she had been kind of airlifted by her parents out of the place that she knew, Mercer Island, and plonked down in Honolulu in 1960 on the campus of the University of Hawaii, a very different kind of place, and encountered immediately this very charismatic African student, and I think was just kind of swept away. How much intention there was there, I do not know, but just by the timing, I agree with you. It doesn't seem like this was something she intended to do. It seems quite possible that she accidentally became pregnant, and then she had to kind of do the first big correction in her life. Her life is so interesting to me because it is this series of improvisations. When we look back on it, especially from the perspective of her son becoming president, we think, what an interesting kind of visionary life. But when you look at it step by step, she's just kind of open to a series of experiences. They happen, and then she often makes a very good job of sort of correcting for the slight mess that's occurred in the meantime. So I don't know that it was intentional, but I also think she had a slightly tempestuous relationship with her father, who was thought to be quite controlling, and it's possible that that also played a role, according to his brother, in her willingness to take risks that might to us seem rather unwise.
Her first marriage did not last very long at all.
That's right. She discovered at some point that he was already married. He had a wife in Kenya and a child and another child on the way. And then there are various different accounts of this, either that she didn't know this until pretty late in the game, or that he led her to believe that they were separated or divorced, but then it turned out there was no evidence of that, really. But that wasn't the only factor. I think, according to her friends, his attitude toward her seemed to change rather abruptly after they married, which was a few months after she discovered she was pregnant and a few months before the young Barack Obama was born. And he was, I think, always a rather domineering character, but he became more so. And there's one incident that was related to me in which she served him, put a plate of dinner down in front of him, and he looked at it and said, "You expect me to eat this?" and picked it up and hurled it at the wall. And according to what Anne later told this friend, that was one moment where she realized this was not going to work.
It was sort of an irony in her life because her second husband is from Indonesia and also became very domineering after they were married. But all of this was after trying to escape from a father who was very controlling.
That's an interesting point. I don't know that Lolo Sotoro, her Indonesian husband, that it was quite domineering that he became. He became withdrawn, I think, and uncommunicative. I'm not so sure that it was quite the same problem, but yes, there is a pattern there.
My guest is Jenny Scott. She's a reporter for the New York Times, and she's an author of a new book. It's called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And stay with our station beginning at 11 o'clock. President Obama is holding a news conference on the debt ceiling and the status of the budget meetings. NPR's Neil Conan will host this special coverage beginning at 11 here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. The 2011 Jazzoo series continues this Friday, July 15th with Broadway Meets Hollywood, featuring Helen Welch at the Columbus Zoo. Gates open at 6:30 with show at 8. Tickets and details at jazzartsgroup.org.
75 degrees with partly sunny skies. We'll reach a high of 86 today. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 69. A chance of afternoon showers for Saturday and a high of 86. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about Barack Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, named Stanley Ann Dunham, with the author of a new biography of Ann Dunham, Janie Scott. The name of the book is A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Let's move on to her second marriage. We started to talk a little bit about Lolo. How did they meet and what happened to him? He had to return pretty quickly to his home.
That's right, Ann. The interesting thing about this period in which she met both of her husbands was that Hawaii was, you know, it was 1 year into statehood when she arrived there, so it was at a period of incredible sort of growth and excitement in the state. And the University of Hawaii had, in those early years of statehood, had become the place that the federal government funded something called the East-West Center, which brought a huge number of Asian students to the campus of the University of Hawaii, and other foreign students were there as well, and a lot of the sort of energy on the campus had to do with the presence of this new influx of foreign students. And so I think and the fact that Anne first marries an African student and then encounters and marries an Indonesian student is largely a reflection of what the sort of interesting intellectual and cultural ferment that was going on in this campus at the time. So anyhow, she met this very different kind of man, Lolo Satoru, from her first husband. He was said to be, he was a graduate student in geography, and he was said to be, by friends who knew him at the time, you know, wonderfully easygoing and genial, and loved to party and try out his English. He was very good at tennis. Anne told her daughter that she loved the way he looked in his white tennis shorts. And I think she thought, really, this was a kind of a haven from the tumultuous storm of her relationship with Barack Obama, who ultimately had gone on to Harvard, and she had remained in the West, first in Seattle, gone back to Seattle briefly, and then in Hawaii. So she began seeing him, and I think she was very interested in the country he came from, which was coming out from years, really several hundred years of colonial domination, and was coming into its own, and he was planning to go back there and kind of make a mark on the country. I think she was fascinated by that, and so she married him, and then in September of 1965, there was what is now described as what seemed to have been an attempted coup in Jakarta that led to the overthrow or sidelining of Sukarno. And there was a huge political upheaval in that country. As a result of the coup and counter-coup, there was a wave of anti-communist slaughter in which hundreds of thousands of Indonesians are thought to have died. And at that time, all the foreign students, many of whom had ties to the old government, were called back to Indonesia, and so Lolo Satoru abruptly had to return, and the terms of his scholarship or his grant required that when he returned to Indonesia, he would have to do 4 years of government service, according to his relatives. So he was conscripted into the army. In the meantime, Anne was back in Hawaii with her young son, Barack, and finishing her undergraduate degree in anthropology. And in 1967, having got that degree, she picked up her six-year-old half-African son and moved him to Indonesia to join Lolo Satoru.
And you mentioned in the book, I mean, you talked about how perhaps it was his experience after he returned and what happened to him that might have changed his personality somewhat.
Yeah, a year had elapsed and they had not been together, and he was under a lot of pressure once he was back in Indonesia. He was sort of a lighthearted guy in a different culture in Hawaii. That's where she'd gotten to know him. But back in Indonesia, he was under political and government pressure. You know, he was conscripted into the military. The pay was terrible. He was also under cultural and family pressure and expectations to behave in certain ways, for his wife to behave in certain ways. And according to, in particular, to the president's own account of what happened to their relationship in Dreams from My Father, his memoir, but also according to people I interviewed in Indonesia, Anne felt really quite alienated from him and alone when she first arrived there. She began to make friends, a kind of independent set of friends, you know, some of them Western, some of them Indonesian, but because they were living in a household not terribly affluent, but affluent enough to have servants, she was free to go off and work and develop her own social life. So I think they really began to drift apart during that period.
During this period, this will make a huge impression on Barack Obama. One of your sources referred to Barack Obama as, I hopefully am not mispronouncing this, as halus?
Halus.
Halus,
yes.
An Indonesian adjective that means polite, refined, or courteous. Tell us about, you know, how that quality or that trait, how he might have adopted that trait, and how much it was just from picking it up from living there, or did it also require, I guess, a mother's touch as well?
Well, you think about it, you know, the president lived in Indonesia from the age of 6 till almost 10. So this is a pretty important period in a child's development. And he went to Indonesian schools, first a Catholic school and then an Indonesian Muslim school. And in Java in particular, where they were living, there is a real ethic of self-control. To show your emotions, particularly in response to things that other people do to you, is thought to be a sign of weakness. And a sign of strength really is to kind of rise above it, be able to ignore it, laugh it off. And this, according to many Indonesians who I spoke to there, I made several trips to Indonesia reporting on this book, this is inculcated in children through a culture of teasing. And children are teased for all sorts of things, including skin color, hair texture, body type. And it seems that President Obama was teased for a number of things, particularly skin color, because he was really one of very few people of African descent in the city of Jakarta at that time. And there's a wonderful story that was told to me by an American woman who was living in the city of Yogyakarta in the same period that Anne and Barack were there in Jakarta. And she recalled having lunch with them in 1971, shortly before Anne made the decision to send Barack back to Hawaii to join his grandparents and go to a better school. And she said that after the lunch, they went out for a walk, you know, Anne and this woman and another American woman and the young Barack. And some Indonesian children started running alongside them and taunting Barack. And the taunts were racial epithets, and also throwing rocks at him, tossing rocks at him. And he just sort of jumped out of the way and danced around. And according to this woman, it was as though he was playing dodgeball with hidden opponents. And his mother didn't say anything. She didn't intervene in any way. And the woman who was telling me the story said she began to wonder whether Anne understood what was being said and wondered why she hadn't leapt to his defense. And she offered to do it herself, and Anne said, no, he's used to it. So there's some indication that Anne believed, this woman very strongly concluded, that she was trying to teach him a kind of fearlessness and ability to deal with this sort of taunting. And many Indonesians believe that this really underlies some of this a remarkable cool that Americans sometimes find rather baffling about the president.
She didn't really fit in Jakarta. You mentioned earlier that, particularly in that level, the level of society that her husband ran in. You wrote that by Javanese standards, she was a bit sturdy for a woman. She had strong opinions and rarely softened them to please others.
Yeah, she had she's an interesting combination of things. In many ways, she's American and Kansan. She's direct and blunt. But she also had, I think, increasingly some of the manners and some of the sensitivity to other people that that is sort of classically Javanese. But what happened was, after Lolo got out of the military, he was his brother-in-law, who was a high-level person in the Indonesian oil company, helped him get a job with Union Oil. And Lolo's job seems to have been some sort of liaison between the oil company and the government. So he had to spend a lot of time fraternizing with oil company executives and a lot of Western expatriate oil people. And he was a member of a club called the Petroleum Club in Jakarta. And what was expected in that situation, and there's a lot that's expected culturally in Java, was that his wife would be with him. She would be dressed in beautiful form-fitting clothes the way the Indonesian wives did, and she would be making conversation with the other wives about the difficulty of dealing with their servants or that sort of thing. This did not appeal to Anne one bit. She was coming increasingly to love Indonesia. Indonesia and love Indonesians, but that was not the stratum of society she was interested in. Not the expatriate Westerners, and not particularly the upper end, but increasingly interested in ordinary people and people who did handicraft work and sort of the life of the city at a different level. And she began to dig in her heels and not want to attend those events. And that placed further strain between her and created further strain between her and Lolo.
My guest is Jenny Scott. She's the author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. I thought it was interesting when Lolo would complain to her about not going to those functions with the Americans, to socialize with the Americans, and he'd ask her how it would look for him to go alone and remind her that these were her own people. And Barack Obama recalls, I believe it was Barack Obama, it might have been his half-sister, but that her voice would rise to almost a shout and say, "These are not my people." So she did no longer really strongly identified with being an American at that point.
I wouldn't say that it was about being an American.
Okay.
I think it was about
okay.
being a expatriate cut off from Indonesian life. She did not believe, according to her daughter, Maya, she did not believe in living in a country but not being a part of that country. She didn't want to be separated and fraternizing only with Westerners, as is the classic expatriate. And this is a theme that goes through her. She spent the majority of her adult life in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. She never ceased to want to be an American. She maintained her American citizenship. She went back and forth between Hawaii and Indonesia. She loved Hawaii. But I think she felt that if you're going to be in a country, especially if you, because she later had a daughter who was half Indonesian, if you have a child who is part Indonesian, you want to be immersed in that country and that culture and have friends in that culture. And the idea of being of that kind of isolation was what bothered her.
She went on to make quite a mark in banking, and I don't want to go don't want to forget to talk about her career and how it evolved and what she did in terms of the idea of microfinancing in the developing world long before it became a common term.
Yeah, it's a very interesting evolution. She decided to go back to Hawaii and become a graduate student in anthropology. She did her coursework there while Barack was in middle school in Hawaii. And then when she finished the coursework and she had to do her fieldwork, she took her daughter, Maya, whose father was Indonesian and was living in Indonesia at the time, back to Indonesia, leaving Barack with his grandparents so that she could do her fieldwork. She went to work in small villages in Java studying the role of sort of cottage industries, handicraft industries, as a source of subsistence income for relatively poor families. And in the course of doing this research, she discovered that one of the things that held these businesses back and these little industries back was a lack of access to capital. There had always been a view by Western scholars in Indonesia, and that had been somewhat adopted by development people, that the reason these industries didn't get ahead, didn't grow and become more lucrative, was that there was some sort of cultural difference with Indonesians, you know, that they were not interested in capitalism or they weren't sufficiently competitive or whatever. She came to a very different conclusion. She decided that it was really, from what she'd seen, about access to capital. So she then discovered that while she was still pursuing her PhD, that she had a marketable skill. She was very good at talking to these rural peasant workers and learning about those cultures. And that was of great demand in the field of international development. So she became a consultant working on various international development projects funded by organizations like the United States Agency for International Development. Then she went from there to the Ford Foundation in Jakarta, where she was a program officer for 4 years. And then in the late 80s, as you mentioned, she went back to Indonesia, having left for a while her daughter was in high school in Hawaii. She went back to Indonesia, and she became the anthropologist on staff, pretty much, as a consultant to one of the largest government-run commercial banks in Indonesia, which at that time had the largest self-sustaining microfinance program in the world, giving out very small loans ranging from, you know, $50 to $400 to people not in agriculture but in these little industries. At the level of, you know, millions of people were receiving these loans. And what her job was to go around the country with a team of bankers and find out how this was working, do sort of consumer research, understand how you could fine-tune the program to make it more effective, to produce more jobs. So she really was in on the very ground level of this program, which, as you know, and as you mentioned, microfinance now is one of the you know, a staple of not only a household word, but a staple of the of economies in the developing world all over the globe.
You had access to Ann Dunham's professional diaries, and I thought that must have been fascinating to see something like that. What kind of writer was she?
I actually thought she was a wonderful writer. I was very surprised and thrilled when I got to see those field notes that her humor and her wry commentary on people's lives and the absurdity of different things that she saw were all in there, and it gave me a really vivid sense of her voice and her perspective. I was told that she had a very hard time writing, that it took her, you know, it took her almost 20 years to get her PhD because she didn't finish her dissertation. She kept, partly because she kept on doing the research and adding more and more to it. But I was told that she struggled with the writing of it. But I actually thought her writing was very direct and interesting. And her letters, which I also got access to, had a wonderful mix of intimacy and sort of emotional intimacy, but a sort of intellectual rigor. She was quite exacting with her friends and sort of calling them to account, and yet also being very blunt about expressing her strong positive feelings toward them.
As you mentioned earlier, she sent Barack back to Hawaii when he was just about 10 years old for schooling and to live with his grandparents. What kind of feedback do you get from people about that? Was that one of those things that kind of made people ambivalent about her?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think Americans find it very hard to understand why a mother would choose to live apart from her child. What I found is that the circumstances were much more complicated, perhaps, than people take into account. She came from a family that valued education extraordinarily. Going back, you know, a century, they had or more. There were generations of school teachers and educators. Her parents didn't finish college, but everyone else in their generation did. Three of the four went on to graduate school. Two ended up with PhDs. They cared deeply about this, and she did too. She found herself in Indonesia at a time when the schools were not good, and she didn't have access to an English language school for him. And she just felt ultimately she was doing him a disservice by keeping him there when he could be getting, when he needed to get the kind of English language education that would enable him to go to a great university, which she thought was going to be essential for his future. She had enormous faith in his abilities from a very young age and often said to people that he could do anything, including be president. So she sent him back to live with her parents, who happened to live a couple of blocks from one of the best schools in Hawaii. And he went to school there, and then she went back, as I said, and joined him. And then when it came to high school, she had to go and do her field work if she wanted to get her PhD. Plus, she had a child who was half Indonesian, whose father was living in Indonesia. So she wasn't dealing with kind of the level playing field that we imagine on which someone would make this decision. She had one child who had no particular reason to be in Indonesia because he was half African, half American. She had another child who was half Indonesian. She had her own education to pursue and her need to make to be able to work, both by getting her degree and also by working these international development consulting jobs. But she also wanted her kid to have the best education possible. So she did something which she apparently confided to people was the hardest thing she'd ever done. Americans think of it as, many Americans I find who've talked to me about this, find it, they think of it as almost selfish, that she was putting her own needs above his in some way. But in other ways, you can also look at it as somewhat selfless, in that she was giving up the chance to live with her son, which she wanted, in order for him to get the thing that she felt would be important for him in the long run. So it's an ambiguous set of circumstances that I think is quite complicated.
And again, a part of that series of corrections.
Yes, exactly.
That she made. My guest is Jannie Scott. She's author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Previously on Car Talk.
They just said it was covered under warranty, but they would do it anyway.
Are you really cute?
Well,
I mean, you have to ask, right? I mean,
well, sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. It. They charged me $700 for the same thing.
It gives us some idea of the two ends of the spectrum.
Find out more about what goes through the mind of the modern mechanic this week on Car Talk.
And Car Talk begins tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in 20 minutes. Beginning at 11 o'clock, President Obama is holding a news conference on the debt ceiling and the status of the budget meetings. NPR will have special coverage beginning at 11. And we'll have that live right here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
Sunny skies today, a high of 86, mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 69 degrees. There's a chance of a shower or pop-up thunderstorm for Saturday afternoon, a high of 86. A chance of rain Saturday night, a low of 68 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Jenny Scott. She is the author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Jenny, you did, like you mentioned earlier, a couple hundred interviews to prepare this book. I was wondering how much your interviews with the president's half-sister, Maya, contribute to the story.
Pretty substantially. She was very generous with me at a time when her brother was running for president and not even the nominee. She agreed to, you know, talk to me about her mother and continued to talk to me, you know, even as he was in the coming up to the election and certainly for afterward. And she had a very close relationship with her mother, very different in some ways from her brother's relationship. She lived with her mother for her entire childhood. She was homeschooled until about the age of 11 or 12. She went into the field with her mother, spent quite a lot of time as a small child in villages in Java while her mother was interviewing people who worked, you know, in ironworking and batik making and that sort of thing. So she had a very, close, full-time relationship with her mother, and so a very different perspective in some ways than her brother did. And she's a writer herself. In addition to an educator, and she speaks wonderfully and has very vivid memories of this sort of tactile, sensual quality of her experiences in Java as a child. And I think that really helped me understand what that period was like when Anne was living there with a small child and being, in effect, a single mother.
She actually, Maya, has a book out herself this spring. It's a children's book called Ladder to the Moon, a tale of her daughter's adventure with her grandmother.
Yes, Anne. It's an imagined adventure because yes, her daughter was born long after Anne's death, but yes.
It was interesting, the whole idea of the moon, because you talk about when Anne is in New York and away from her home now in Indonesia and how much she misses it. She thinks about the moon and...
Yeah, the moon is sort of a theme in that family's life.
Yeah.
You know, it went back to Madeline Payne's mother. Back in Augusta, Kansas, in the Depression, would take her children out and, you know, explain the constellations and look at the moon. Yeah. And you often hear that described about Anne's childhood, about looking at the sky and looking at the moon, a sort of interesting kind of leitmotif that seems to symbolize this notion of some distant horizon and curiosity about it.
You said that when you interviewed the president in the Oval Office, he spoke about his mother with fondness, humor, and a degree of candor that you had not expected.
Well, I think people's relationships with their parents are extremely complicated and very hard to speak about succinctly, hard to speak about honestly, because you're summarizing so much, and so it's very difficult to get the balance right. And I was struck by the nuance and balance in what he was able to tell me in a relatively short amount of time, necessarily so because he's the president. While he made it very clear how much, in many ways, his mother had shaped him and how much he admired her example, particularly in his choice of the line of work he went into and her very deeply felt belief in that the most important thing one could do with one's life is to help other people, to create opportunity for people who had less. At the same time, he also spoke about her limitations as a parent in ways that I thought seemed quite honest. He said she was, while she was strong in her own way, she was extremely disorganized, and that disorganization spilled over into his young life and to his and his sister's young lives. He also said that he had made a real choice in his life not to embrace one particular aspect of her example, which is her kind of global citizen expatriate lifestyle. He said he, while he understood the appeal of that adventure, new people, wonderful food, it was not what made him comfortable, and he felt that it bespoke a certain lack of commitment. It could bespeak a certain lack of commitment and an observer's quality that he really didn't want for his own life. So he'd made a very conscious decision to move to Chicago, root himself in Chicago, marry a woman from Chicago, and make create a kind of stable base for his children that he had not had as a child.
How did she feel about that, and how did she feel about the identity that he eventually embraced, which was more of an African-American identity, more of a Black identity?
I heard a little bit about this, not a lot, and whether that's because people were reluctant to bring it up or that it was something that she didn't talk about, which I think is probably more likely the explanation, I'm not sure. But one close friend of hers who was a colleague who had traveled extensively with her in Indonesia and also lived in a house in which she and a couple of other people lived in at the time told me that around the time that Barack Obama was sort of beginning to get interested in political life in Chicago, this would be in the early 90s after law school, and immersing himself in Chicago and increasingly self-identifying as African-American, that Anne did express to this friend a sense of, he said it wasn't quite a feeling of rejection, but a sort of wistful sense that her son was distancing himself from her, and that this choice to self-identify as African-American was what this friend described as a professional choice that to Anne, you know, was difficult for her to fully grapple with because she felt it was not really a part of his childhood. Now, obviously, he was interested in going into public life, and he's half African, and in the United States, that is taken to be African American. So one might say, well, he didn't exactly have any choice, but I do think she had some personal, emotional response to that. That was a sense of distance.
The impact of Anne Dunham, I suppose some could say, continues to have on Barack Obama is seen even now through policy and practice, as we can hear here with the recent call for health care reform.
Today, I'm signing this reform bill into law on behalf of my mother, who argued with insurance companies even as she battled cancer in her final days.
That's a pretty emotional note to sign a bill on. And it was very personal for him to bring that up, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it must have, her death, which happened quite precipitously and at a relatively young age.
In 1995, she mentioned.
In 1995, at the age of 52, I think was a very, must have been, as it would be for anyone, but perhaps more so than some, very difficult thing for him. He was, at the time, wrapped up in many different endeavors. He was had just launched his first political campaign to run for the Illinois State Senate. He had just published his memoir, Dreams from My Father. He was working as a lawyer in a firm, and he was teaching part-time at the University of Chicago. And his mother became ill and went back from Indonesia to Hawaii and was being treated for cancer, but was the kind of person who didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on her illness. She was very, according to people who knew her well during that period, quite upbeat, seemed intent on fighting it, seemed for a long time to believe that she could. And then when she realized perhaps that it was going to kill her, she just sort of lived out the rest of her life. But she would not have spent a lot of time impressing upon her children how ill she was and how time was limited and how they needed to be with her. So the president told me that he was in telephone contact with her. He saw her in September. She died in November. He saw her in September in New York when she was getting a second opinion. And then he was in phone contact with her. But she became unconscious and some days later died. And her daughter was at her bedside in the hospital in Honolulu. But the president was not there. He wasn't the president, obviously, at the time. And he has said that was the worst mistake he's ever made, not being with his mother when she died. And I think that clearly must be a factor in his willingness to bring that up. Also, it's true she did struggle with her insurance company. I had access to a lot of her correspondence with her insurance company, and while she did have health insurance, her disability coverage was subject to a clause that a pre-existing condition clause, and the insurance company decided that her condition predated the policy, and therefore she should not be paid for the money she could no longer collect because she was unable to work.
What was it that she most contributed to the man the world knows as the president of the United States now? What was it, that outsider quality? Was it the ability to be teased and shake it off? Was it the genetic stuff of his brilliance, which she shared, or adaptability because of all the moves?
You know, it's so hard to sum it all up. And mm-hmm. I think the thing about reading her story is that you really think about the president in a new way, just to know that this is the person who was the fundamental influence early in his life. There's so many things. In addition to what you say, there's physical attributes that are really remarkable. His smile, his ears, his chin, his teeth. There's
his
so
eyes.
Much that is like his mother. Yeah. But on top of that, so many aspects of his values that he has openly said. The sense that you could reach across vast divides, seemingly vast divides, cultural, racial, ethnic, geographical, and make contact with people who seem so different from you on the surface, that so much came from his mother, not only the way she talked to her children, but particularly the way she lived. She had done work in Java that was described to me by one of her superiors as, in effect, community organizing in Java 5 years before he became a community organizer in Chicago. There are so many ways in which she influenced him, even, I think, probably his sense of humor. It's just really interesting to kind of understand her life and then reflect on him in light of those facts.
Have you ever heard a recording of her voice?
I have, and I was actually surprised by it. I heard two recordings of her voice, one made in the early 80s in Jakarta and speaking to a group of largely expatriate audience about handicrafts, and then another one made while she was working in a job in New York in the early 90s. At that point, her voice was quite high and refined. One person described it to me as almost Javanese. And, you know, she had apparently a fantastic earthy laugh, which I think you hear in her daughter. But her voice at that point had a slightly high that kind of tone, almost gentle and toned down, which was not what I'd imagined when juxtaposed with her famous bluntness.
And I was wondering if she sounded at all like him, because he's so well known for his syntax, for his way of talking.
Well, if you're talking about syntax, possibly, she certainly was very literate. She read a lot. She had huge collections of books, and she's also impressed upon her children the importance of that, and they very much adopted that and, you know, exchanged books with each other, exchanged books with her. So they speak in those sort of wonderful paragraphs and full sentences. I was talking more, I thought you were asking more about the tone.
The actual tone. Well, both, kind of both. You know, he has said, Barack Obama has said, that his mother gave him the single most important gift a parent can give. Quote, a sense of unconditional love that was big enough that with all the surface disturbances of our lives, it sustained me entirely.
Yeah, that's what he said to me, that despite all these distances and changes and sendings away and rejoinings, et cetera, that we find so curious, he feels that he knew from a very young age that his mother believed he was special and loved him boundlessly, and that he said, as much as anything, underlay his confidence and self-esteem and his sort of sureness that we've all noticed. And he said, obviously, some of that is temperament, but it also, he felt, came from that.
Did she give much direction to her parents when she sent him there to live with them, or was it sort of have at it?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think on the level of education, they were sort of on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
but I don't know what she told them about other things, because I think his decision to stay partly for high school with his grandparents rather than return with his mother was partly a feeling that he didn't want to be plunged back into a different culture again at that point. But it was also that he's described this in Dreams from My Father, that he felt he could sort out some big questions for himself, including his racial identity, outside of the scrutiny of his mother, and to some extent would be given a kind of leeway by his grandparents that she didn't give him.
You know, it was clear to many that Ann Dunham believed that that maybe Barack Obama in particular was unusually gifted. She bragged about his brains and his achievements and how brave she thought he was. And she even, as you mentioned earlier, boasted that he could be president of the United States. But later on, when he graduated from Harvard Law School and someone suggested that he would be president, she started to cry.
Yes, this was a man who was very close to her late in her life, an Indonesian man, and he told me he knew her for very closely for years. I mean, I'd say, you know, 5 or 6 years, and he said it was the one time he saw her cry, and he was very startled by it. He thought he was being clever, you know. She had said that he was going to go work in a pro bono law firm, doing pro bono work, and this man said, "Oh, so he wants to be president," and thinking he knew, you know, the way things work in America. And to his amazement, she began to weep, and he said to me, "I couldn't tell what the reason was, you know, whether it was a sense of the racism that he might encounter being, you know, a black man running for president in the United States, or whether it was the sense of his sort of moving way beyond her reach. But there was something about that really upset her." Which I thought was a very interesting. Her children talk about her as a person who was moved to tears quite often, yet most of her other friends and colleagues never saw that. So I think where it came to her children, she was highly emotional. But, you know, in the rest of her life, she kept it pretty much under wraps.
Jannie, thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it has been for me too, Anne. Thank you.
It's Jannie Scott. She is a New York Times reporter and also author of a new book. It's called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Symphony. The Saturday's Picnic with the Pops features virtuoso guitarist Daryl Sturmer reinventing the Genesis experience. Concerts are held on the lawn of Chemical Abstract Service. Tickets and details at picnicwiththepops.com.